This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Impact of influence.
Covering true crime throughout the Southeast.
Hello, friend. Welcome back. Impact of Influence. Again, we're so grateful that you're going to spend time with us today. Really, really appreciate it. Matt Harris, Seton Tucker here. Impact of Influence on Facebook. Impact of Influence YouTube channel. Hopefully you'll subscribe. Hopefully you'll review and share the episode and comment. That'd be great, too. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to shift back into Murdoch world again today for the first part of this. And then we're going to talk to Michael DeWitt.
Well, that's Murdoch too.
That is Murdoch too. Yes. It's all Murdoch.
Mostly a Murdoch episode.
Yes.
So if you are into the Murdoch stuff, you're here for it today.
You're here for it today. Then we'll head back on over to the rest of true crime in the Southeast. But we start with Alec Murdoch and the Fed saying, "You're a liar, liar, pants on fire." They did not officially say that, but not in those words.
Well,
what happened?
Okay, so he is scheduled to be sentenced on April 1st for the financial federal crimes. The federal government has now filed a motion saying they are seeking to void the plea agreement that they had reached because Murdoch flunked his polygraph.
Yeah, you fail a polygraph, which is, the polygraphs don't hold up in court, but it was part of his deal.
Yeah, so I guess it is common if you get a plea deal with the federal government that they require you to take a polygraph exam. And I guess his deal was that his sentence would run concurrently with his state sentence at the same time. I think this is maybe a last chance bid to get out of jail when he's in his mid-70s.
Assuming that he would somehow get off on the murder charges.
Yeah, his bid for a new trial, his appeal would have to be successful, he'd have to get a new trial, and then he would have to be found innocent of the murders of Maggie and Paul. He has 27 years for his state crimes that Judge Newman sentenced him to, so this will put him in his 70s. So,
right. He, again, pled guilty, but you feel the polygraph. They interviewed him four times, right? U.S. Attorney's Office and FBI.
Right. He was interviewed four times, and they were seeking to get answers on where all this $6 million of unaccounted for money is.
I always wondered what the exact amount of unaccounted money for, because we really haven't heard an exact figure. It's been bantered about, like, within a range. But
in their filing, they say $6 million. I guess if he had refused to take this polygraph examination, that would have avoided his plea too.
So he has
to do it. So if he doesn't take it, they're saying you can't, the plea is no good. And if you fail it, the plea is no good. So, I mean, he had to take it because before I read the document, I was like, well, why is he taking this examination?
I
think that was part of the requirement to get this plea.
And
they say he had every opportunity to be honest. I mean, they interviewed him four times. This polygraph was October 18th of 2023. And they say that they had two series of questions that were asked, and the examiner found deception on both series. Now, what's interesting is we don't know what these questions are because the federal government has also filed a separate motion to keep these exhibits secret.
Because of ongoing investigations.
Yes.
So if they're trying to track down the money and maybe there's other people involved, they don't want word getting out where they're sniffing around, maybe.
Right. And in the filing, they did indicate that one lawyer is being investigated. So we don't know who this lawyer is. Their person is not named. There's been a lot of speculation online about who that may be. We have the lawyer in Hilton Head who, you know, was, I think, that said, you know, he's being investigated for some offshore money, did insurance stuff.
For and a separate he, of
right, right, and
but,
he,
but since he knows that connection.
And he had a, what he had a, I think he's got a deal with the Fed government for his charges. But there, so there's that guy. Then there's also people say, well, you know, you have other lawyers who work closely with Alec Murdoch, whether they're at PMPED or whether, you know, like Chris Wilson, his friend he was talking to.
Right.
On his way but all that's to his all mother's just house the night of the murders. It's all pure speculation. Yeah,
point.
People. But what
it could be,
is not
it could be a lawyer we don't even know
a
about.
Who, it,
he just hired
yes,
somewhere
be
to be my guy to take
separate.
My money and do something with it.
Right. So I am thinking that Judge Gergel will probably not hold the plea agreement. And
no.
I'm thinking no way he's running those sentences concurrently.
So it might be the same amount of time. But it won't be concurrent.
Right. And I think the state paper, John Monk's article, said that Gergel has a history of giving tough sentences to white-collar criminals.
Yeah, it's not good for old Alec.
But it is interesting, though, because the science of polygraphs is really disputed. They're not admissible in the state
right.
of South Carolina.
Or, like, I was reading an article today, and I'm going to try to get the guy on who wrote the book. His book is called, let me scroll up here, Tremors in the Blood, Murder Obsession, and the Birth of the Lie Detector. Guy who was the editor of Wired magazine, and his article is tells you about the Court of Appeals, District of Columbia, Supreme Court, and a lot of these things just aren't flying. And his article, part of what I read, is mainly talking about how they use it against people who don't have influence and people who are of lesser means. And they can get false confessions based on it and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying Alec is innocent of squat. I'm just saying the science of the
I want to look more into this. I think I would fail any poly. I would just be so nervous that I would fail. But
you almost think, though, the way to Alec would pass them all because he's such a somewhat sociopath.
Yeah,
whatever.
Maybe he thought he was going to. Maybe he believed he was going to pass it. But also, you know, what's he hiding? There's that. Why is he hiding it? Because he's
gigs up. But unless he's hiding money somewhere that he's hope he'll get to when he's out or his family will
or
find out about.
Or he can give it to, yeah, give it to family. I don't
Who
know.
Knows?
Jim Griffin told the state paper that he was planning to file a response. We have not received that response as of this recording. Now, Eric Bland, who represents several of the victims of financial crimes, took to Twitter and said something along the face that he was not aware of this deal that Alec had worked out with the federal government. And he felt like it was a slap in the face to the victims.
Well, I don't know the history of these kind of deals, but he's not going to get it. The odds of him getting out are so incredibly slim.
Yeah.
Them overturning the murder convictions.
Well, right? Maybe he's trying to protect his friends at this point. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, who knows? He could have been lying about that, right? Some of the questions might have been, was so-and-so involved? Was so-and-so involved?
Yeah, that's true.
We don't know.
We don't know because for the time being, that information is sealed.
But who? Maybe names will be coming out.
Yep. So let's move on to Becky Hill.
Sure.
She held a press conference this week, which was a little strange.
Yeah, very strange.
Do you want to, should we play?
Let's play a piece of Becky Hill, the Colleton County Clerk of Courts.
One of the biggest trials in South Carolina history. Our small town came together and made everyone proud. Managing a trial was such importance to the people of South Carolina, as well as of the national and international media, interest, and public scrutiny, and has caused me to reflect upon decisions involving my stay in the office of the Clerk of Court. And so, after much reflection, I have decided that it is best not to run again for re-election. I will now be able to focus on being a wife, a mother, and grandmother to my two grandboys, and will be spending time with the people who mean the most to me. And so, as we fix our eyes forward, I would like to announce also that my resignation as Clerk of Court will be effective immediately. Thank you.
Okay, so
let's talk about her demeanor. Like, at first, she was smiling the entire time. She had her staff standing behind her, and they all looked pretty miserable. But
they looked pretty miserable.
They did. Nobody, it was, but yeah. She was smiling. I don't know. Maybe she's medicated or something. It was almost like she was accepting some sort of award.
And the attorney Bamberg was there, Justin Bamberg, who's also a congressperson.
Her attorney was standing beside her. Her other attorney, Will Lewis, was not at this press conference.
I wonder in the history of the clerk of court, if there's ever been a big presser about I'm resigning and not rerunning. I think that's right. Just kind of a position where you just maybe make a press release or something.
And somebody asked Justin Bamberg about whether her resignation or decision not to run again had anything to do with the active investigation that was going on. And he said, absolutely not. And, you know, she's saying she wants to spend more time with family and her grandkids. But the fact that it was effective today, I mean, and we were contacted by SLED.
Yes.
About our interview we did with her. They wanted to know exactly when this interview occurred and what the time frame. And I think she did the interview during her lunch break with us. I mean, she was at the Twig store.
Oh, she was. Right.
And we usually record around lunchtime. And so I believe her interview with us was during the lunch hour.
And SLED had heard or used the podcast and they wanted the raw audio and stuff. I'm like, what difference does it make? So yeah, but we got it to them. We'll see what happens. But obviously they're investigating because that was only just a couple weeks ago.
Right. So there is still obviously an investigation going on by SLED.
Right. But again, just I thought it was kind of nothing personal. Becky might be, it was always nice to us.
She's always very nice to us.
It's just it was an odd thing to do to go out and make a big announcement if the spotlight's not what you want.
No. But in her defense, I mean, I think based on what she said there, I don't think she thinks she did anything wrong.
No, I mean, yeah, she just...
She said she reflected on some of the things.
Yeah, she did reflect on it.
She reflected, but I don't know that she believes that she did anything wrong, and she hasn't been convicted of anything at this time.
Not even charged.
Not charged.
All right, going to take a little break and talk about one of our sponsors. They support us. Hopefully, you'll support them. And who doesn't love going to the movies?
It is my favorite date night activity, and my daughter, she's a huge moviegoer.
Oh, yeah. I just went to, Kung Fu Panda 4 the other week at Regal Cinemas, and they're doing this cool thing called Regal Unlimited. Explain, Seton.
It is an all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just two visits.
Nice.
You can see any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions.
Love that. And also, if you want to do the souped-up versions, you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost.
And you don't just save on tickets, you also save on snacks.
Members get 10% off all non-alcoholic concession items. So if you're planning to see two movies this month, you need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. regmovies.com/unlimited. And use our code IMPACTREG. REG. Impact REG. Do it now. Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and it is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
What did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code IMPACT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's IMPACT50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And we are happy to bring in our guest, Michael DeWitt, who you just saw in Charleston this past week, Seton. And his book is The Fall of the House of Murdoch. Writes for the USA Today network of newspapers, and he is a longtime Hampton resident, so he knows all about the Murdoch family. We're going to talk to him about the book, but we want to start with the passing of Libby Murdoch. Good day, Michael. Glad to have you back.
Hello, friends.
Did Libby actually teach you?
She did. I've known the, well, if you're from Hampton, you knew the family, but I've known the family my entire life. I don't remember what year. It might have been multiple years, but when I went to school, North District Middle School was a four-year school, grades 5 through 8, and she taught English, reading, literature. It was all kind of one class together. And I don't remember exactly what grade it was, but she was my teacher, and then I went on to cover her on the school board when I went to work for the paper.
She is, of course, the wife of Solicitor Randolph Murdoch III, the mother of Attorney Richard Ehrlich Murdoch, who's been is in jail now for killing his wife and son. She was 85 years old. She was under hospice care. She had been suffering from dementia for a while, and she died on March 26th.
Michael, you wrote an article for the Greenville News where you talk about the history of the Murdoch women. I thought it was a really interesting historical article. Can you hit some of the highlights for us?
Yeah, absolutely. With this Murdoch story, it's so competitive, and there are journalists all over the world writing about this crime saga and this family and trying to get the next scoop. And I always try to be different. I want to stand out. If I can't be better, I want to be different. So I've written, you know, all these historical features looking back at the family's history, but I also believe I was the only writer to write about the Murdoch women, the Murdoch wives. And in the course of going through the, you know, researching for the two books, going through the newspaper archives and other historical documents, books, I found that the Murdoch women were fascinating, and they played a very important role. While you may have the men on the front page of the newspaper for a criminal case or something like that, the women were having, they kind of kept things going on the social front. They kept the Murdoch family in touch with the community. Alex's grandmother, Gladys, was a national flower judge, and they had like garden parties and things of that nature. And their comings and goings and parties were all over the society pages. But they were more than just trophy wives and
accessories, the words I think you used.
Sam Cruz, the local historian, said that they were not just accessories.
Yeah.
Yeah, they, obviously things change when Gladys Murdoch, which is Buster's wife, obviously she went to, I believe she went to Columbia College as well, but she had a degree in home economics, and that's what a lot of the women of that era did. But Libby was a very intelligent, highly educated woman. She was an honor student, honor graduate, just a very intelligent educated woman. And throughout the generations, they had that in common. They were accomplished women. They came from good families. They came from, you hear the name Alexander. That was Libby's maiden name. And the Alexanders are one of the founding families of the town of Brunson here in Hampton County. And that's where Alex gets his name, Richard Alexander Murdoch. They pass it down. These rich white folks like to pass their family names down one way or the other.
Yeah.
But yeah, they came from wealthy, well-to-do families, but they were intelligent, educated, accomplished women.
President of the school board as well?
That's right. I don't remember how many years. I think it was roughly 30-something years. She was a classroom teacher. I think she started teaching in the Columbia area when she first married Randolph, and took a break to have 4 kids and kind of had them pretty close together, and then went back to school right here in Hampton School District 1 and retired, and then ran for the District 1 school board. So she was a board member for several terms, and then one or two terms, she was the chairperson of the school board.
I have a lot of teachers in the family, so I always appreciate teachers. Your dad's a professor. And the fact that Libby chose to teach for all those years and be on the school board when she wasn't doing it for the money, that's for sure, as most
clearly
teachers aren't.
Clearly, she did not have to work.
Right. So you were talking about the book, The Fall of the House of Murdoch and History.
Right. So, you have a lot of this historical information in your book, and I think you've said just a few minutes ago that you kind of wanted to take a different approach than other authors doing Murdoch books. Have you always been interested in history, and how did you decide to take this approach?
That's a good question, and whenever I do presentations and lectures at these book signings, I address it, tell my story a little bit. I never, I'm not a natural true crime person, and I never wanted to be a historian. I was always had a career plan. I was going to be an outdoor writer, and I wanted to be the next Louis Grizzard, and I wrote humor, and I just reached a point where my humor columns were being syndicated throughout Gannett's national news network, and I was working on a humor book when I was approached by a national publishing company, Arcadia Publishing, which is the History Press as well, and they asked me if I wanted to do a history of Hampton County, and this was back in 2015. And I'd already been doing some volunteer work with Salkehatchee Stew, where we interviewed people from World War II, the Great Depression, and wrote plays for the theater based on their real life experiences. So I'd already been doing a little bit of historical stuff, and I enjoyed being a playwright or a co-playwright, you know. And I was asked to do a history book because I had all the archives right there in my office. I had all this history available to me. And I said, sure, you know, I'll put my humor plans on hold and I'll do this history book. So the very first Michael DeWitt book is Images of America, Hampton County. It's a photo history of our hometown, published 2015. And then in the course of doing that book, I found all these dark stories, these moonshine and murder stories in Hampton County's history. And I didn't know what to do with them, and they didn't fit into that book project. So I just kind of put them up for a rainy day. And as John Monk wrote in an article recently, that rainy day happened when Alex Murdoch went on a crime spree. Mm-hmm. So that's why I went ahead and published or wrote those two history books. So I guess you could say I'm an unwilling historian.
Well, you do a lot of book signings around the area and the Lowcountry. For the Fall of the House of Murdoch and your other books. So when people approach you about the Fall of the House of Murdoch, what is like the number one question or comment or thing that they have for you about that?
That's a good question. You know, I've got a lot of enthusiasm about both books. People just tell me they can't wait to read it. They really enjoyed my reporting and the historical things I've done for USA Today and Greenville News and the other newspapers. And so basically, you know, I'm just getting a welcome feeling from the readers, enthusiasm. Like, we just can't wait to read it. And we like your style. You have a way of telling a story that's both, you know, spellbinding, but also with a touch of humor. And,
right.
And you know, every writer likes to hear that, you know.
Yes, yes.
I attended an event that you were speaking at along with another author, Jason Ryan, at the College of Charleston this week. And the subject was sensationalism in news. And obviously, this is a very sensational story. How have you as a journalist approached that and tried to stay true to your journalistic ethics?
Well, it's hard. It kind of limits you sometimes. I mean, I can't use anonymous sources. I can't report on rumor, even if I feel in my heart that something is true, that something happened. If I can't prove it, I don't like to report on it. And I tried to take that same approach in my books. And, you know, there's always, if you slander someone, you can always open yourself up to lawsuits and things of that nature. So I try to make sure there's a document, a newspaper archive or something that supports everything I write. And it kind of limited me a little bit because we call it creative nonfiction. You know, you want to take history and make it interesting. So you use a little bit of creativity and you use storytelling techniques that a fiction writer, a novelist would use to write real life events. But, you know, there's a temptation there to use your imagination. Like, for example, the night the train wreck happened and killed Randolph Murdoch Sr. You know, I wanted to let my imagination go wild and write about the sound and fury of the, you know, I did some of that. But I kept it to fact-based documents. I used the facts and then, didn't get too carried away with the imagination. So what the reader reads is as true as I can make it.
Well, another thing you discussed at this event was Hampton really not being much different than a lot of places. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the good old boy network that was there, but you kind of compared them to mafia in other places. Do you think Hampton and this corruption that has been uncovered there is all that different than a lot of places?
That's a good question. The professor that was moderating the session in Charleston, he couldn't believe my answer. And my answer was this: this story is very unique. You'd be hard pressed to find another crime saga that plays out just like Alex Murdoch's did, captured an international audience. Mm-hmm. But the setting is not unique. I mean, you can find corruption in any small town or any big city, anywhere in America, anywhere in the world. And it's not always necessarily corruption. It's just you can call it down south, you can call it the good old boy network. Up north, and you know, in the city, you may call it the mafia. But think about it. The example I used was connections. If you're in a small town and you're looking for a job, you got a brother who works for this company, or a sister or an aunt that works for this company, well, you call people you know and you ask for favors. Hey, can you get me a job? Or if your relative is on the police force, hey, can you get me out of this speeding ticket? And these are small examples, but these are examples of things that happen every day, and they work at a larger scale to become corruption, you know. Right. And it's not unique to Hampton. There are good old boys in every town in America. You put a good journalist in any town anywhere, give him a month, and he'll tell you who the crime boss is, who the boss hog is, and you'll find that they're not very much unlike Hampton.
Well, influence. It's all about influence, right? The impact of influence. See how I worked it around to us. But yeah, but it is, every, you know, you use your connections, a lot of people do, to better your life or better your situation.
And that was a discussion that came up related to Paul, that, you know, the boating accident.
Yeah. The example I used was, doesn't make it right necessarily, but if you have the power or ability to help get your child out of trouble, what would you do? Would you let your child go to prison? Would you try to help your child? So we're not excusing any bad behavior, but after generations of entitlement, it's easy to see how these things happen.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we're not, like what I said earlier, try to help your kid or help your stock in life or your job. Or not necessarily saying everything's right. It works in a lot of cases. Now, Alec took it to the super extreme.
That's right.
Well, and I think, people, of course, you want to help your child get an attorney and that sort of thing. I think a lot of people, just the general perception is that nothing changed in his life. He was able to go back to USC and carry on as if nothing had happened.
Right. And whereas other people without the influence would have been a lot more trouble is the thinking.
Right. I mean,
there should be consequences.
There should be consequences for sure.
Absolutely. And I think I said it in a previous interview with you guys that if Michael DeWitt's son would have been in that boat, he'd still be in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's an example of taking things to the extreme and never having to be accountable for anything. When you've got this legacy of power and connection and you're never held accountable, right. You see, it could lead to death and disaster.
Were you surprised about Alec's involvement in these financial crimes?
No, not at all. It was no shocker to people in Hampton County that a man named Murdoch would steal. You know, we've heard for generations that Buster Murdoch, Alex's grandfather, was a crook and was involved in moonshine. And there was something about Alex. When you shook his hand and looked him in the eye, you just got a vibe like, you know, he was just a shady politician, shady lawyer. And so I didn't find that surprising at all. And like I said, in Charleston, the murders, that's what surprised me and everyone locally. The Murdochs were known to be a tight-knit group. They loved family. The Murdoch attorneys doted on their family and their family name, and they were proud of it. And to for a Murdaugh to murder a member of their family. That was the single most shocking thing of all. Hmm.
The Fall of the House of Murdaugh is the book. You should grab it. He also has The Wicked Hampton County. You should check that out as well.
Really enjoyed your book. Highly recommend it.
I want to add that with the passing of Libby Murdaugh, it's kind of sad that her life and legacy, just like her husband Randolph, their life and their legacy is now forever tainted by the actions of Alex. And, if this hadn't happened, I'm sure there was a massive turnout for her funeral. I saw a lot of support online for the family, and she'll always be remembered as a great, talented educator. But imagine if Alex hadn't committed these crimes, what her legacy would look like.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, how do they find your book? Where do they go?
Well, we're on Amazon. We're also on eveningpostbooks.com.
Cool.
And I'll be doing a few more book signings around until the summer.
And we'll keep trying to post them on the Impact of Influence Facebook page so they know where to find you. Appreciate it, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Make me sound smart. Appreciate it.
If you can make us sound smart, we can definitely make you sound definitely smarter than us.
It's more of a challenge to make us sound smart than you. Exactly. You're the writer here. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Take care.
See you, Mike. Bye. All right. To wrap, we have a comment from a listener. You can do that through Impact of Influence on Facebook. The Impact of Influence YouTube channel will get rolling. And we'd like to rate and share, part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. On our last episode about Katie Major and the train, I don't want to say accident because we don't, that's what they rule, or they ruled it was a suicide. But there's so many questions.
There's so many questions. And I spoke to her mother this week, and she did have one correction. Actually, in our episode, we said that she died on January 8th, but it was actually January 17th of 2008.
Listener comment. Very sad episode. Y'all do an amazing job with all the episodes. All during the Murdaugh episodes, you remain very mutual and never seem to influence based on your thoughts, which in listening to every single podcast you have done, I still have no clue if either of your thoughts were guilty or not. Your episodes have been very informative, excellent guests. I look forward to each week's episode. To me, it's true journalism, presenting facts and legal information about the process, excellent reporting and discussion. Thanks for you for what you both do. Also, that your ability to show compassion in your reporting.
Oh, that was very sweet. One of my favorite comments that we've ever received, because I like it when people kind of get us, because that was our goal. We just wanted to present the information and really try to minimize our opinions.
We discuss things. Yes. Like a lot of times, another comment that I'll paraphrase was like, you guys just don't read everything. Like a lot, and that's to each their own, whatever they do. But they're like, we don't like the fact that you just read everything, even though it's probably sloppy at times. But we just kind of discuss.
Well,
and
we've
banter.
Already established that I'm not a strong reader.
That's true. Wouldn't want her to be reading the whole story.
It's true. But so I spoke to Katie Major's mom this past week, and she, I have a lot of questions. She gave me a lot of information, and we're still kind of working on getting more information. So there's going to be more to come. But one thing Vicky pointed out was, that the only person that described Katie's behavior as abnormal or paranoid was Aaron, not one other person, including her medical doctor. And I'm going to do more on this, but I spoke with my sister-in-law, who's an OBGYN. I'll get all the facts together, but it's really rare for someone to be suffering from postpartum depression when they're pregnant.
Yes, Katie was pregnant.
And it's not common.
And we're still confused about the other daughter in the stream or pond or creek, what was it? Yeah, because that was way far away from the train tracks, or far enough away that it couldn't have just, child wouldn't have flown there.
There are so many questions about this. Aaron was familiar with the area that they found. He hunted this area. So there's a lot of questions surrounding her death and how it was investigated. The family still really finds it so perplexing that her death is still ruled a suicide. And but they had Aaron was named as a
suspect.
Suspect.
So you have a suspect, but it's ruled this. But I mean, there might be some technical reasons why.
Yes, and I really want to do a deeper dive into this, and
maybe we can have one of our pathologists maybe look at the autopsy results.
There's a lot of questions about, her injuries and if those are consistent with the story.
Kadie Major, check it out, the news stories, and check out our podcast. About that. Any final words for the folks other than hi, love you.
Happy Easter if you are I'm glad to celebrate that.
There you go. We will talk again soon, friend.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an evergreen podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.